Hey, so have you heard the rumor that the restaurant guys are introducing a call-in component to the show? Well, guess what? It's true. So if you have a question for the restaurant guys or something you'd like us to discuss on the air, call us at 732-828-9459. Call anytime from anywhere. We'll answer your questions and who knows, maybe even have you on one of our upcoming Restaurant Guys call-in shows. The number to call is 732-828-9459, 732-828-9459 from anytime or anywhere.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Yeah,
I'm really
well.
Great. Yeah, things are really great. I'm loving this particular year that we're in, and I see...
Nice to see people back in the restaurants
again.
Yeah,
the energy in 2010 is just... first of all, business is up, thank God.
It's really nice to see people back in the restaurants again, and more than seeing people in the restaurants, because you know, business isn't up as a percentage. It's not up that much more than it was. But people have lost that I'm scared to death look in
their
eyes.
Oh, my God.
I'm scared to death. I have to go out to dinner because somebody made me, but I'm scared to death.
The tenor of conversation, the you can hear the conversation in the room is different.
It's lighter. It's light. Yeah, absolutely. People are out to have fun, not just because they're obligated to go out.
Or you know, or like it's their last meal. In 08, a lot of people were like, well, we're out tonight. Things are just so bad. We had to go out to dinner, and it's so nice to see you guys. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's good. Here you are, have an emergency bottle of Burgundy. Are you okay? And, you know, I was like, you wanted to burn incense, hold hands, and cry. You know? Oh, my God. So things are a lot more normal this year. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks, spending never went down. Mm-hmm. For a lot of folks, it's back up to where it was. And some people have found a new normal that's a little bit lower than it used to be.
Yep.
But they're like, listen, let's go out to dinner. We'll have a couple bottles of wine. You know, life is good. I've still got my job. And, you know, I feel terribly for those people who don't. I know there are a lot of people struggling, and I don't mean to minimize that one little bit. But there's a little bit of light in the economy, and hopefully that means that jobs are on the way for those people.
Yeah, I was going to say, even the people who aren't currently employed, at least there's more and more opportunity. Listen, we're hiring more people than we've been hiring. We didn't fire anybody, but we reduced our hiring.
We didn't fire anybody, but we had some white knuckles on that ride,
sure,
I'll tell you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it hasn't been an easy year and a half, 2 years.
We did fire one guy for cause, and he did something that really merited being fired, and I was like, oh, thank God.
I don't know which guy you're talking about, so I'm going to let you expound.
There was a guy that got fired from our kitchen who was a fairly high-ranking guy, and he got fired because he did some stuff that merited getting fired. And he would have gotten fired anyway, and we just didn't replace him.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't fire anybody because of the economic downturn. But when I'm working that hard to make sure that everybody still has a job, and you do something egregious that is wrong and willful.
Well, and I remember...
I didn't feel bad about letting him go.
And I remember what one of the things this person said as he was going is he came back and said, well, you know, I'd really like another chance. And our response to him was, listen, you've done something egregious. You've done something that
after being warned several times.
After being warned four or five times. You've done something egregious that merits being fired. Now what you're telling me is in order to keep – now I'm going to have to cut hours.
Right.
So – for me, I'm going to cut hours. I'm going to cut everybody's hours of the people who are doing their jobs, working hard, doing the right thing, being very interested in making sure that the restaurant is healthy. And I'm going to take hours from all of those people, and I'm going to give them to you.
Right, I got
to
shave 5 hours.
I got to shave
eight guys.
I got to shave I got to shave 40 hours off of labor in the kitchen in order to maintain, what we need to maintain to keep things moving forward. I have a choice. I can take 40 hours off of the guy who should be fired, or I can take 5 hours a week off of the eight other guys in the kitchen who are doing a great job. No-brainer.
Can't do it, man.
It's a no-brainer.
Can't do it. Anyway, so we did downsize our kitchen staff by one, and fortunately, we just didn't replace him. And it's looking like in the fall we're going to have to. Thank heaven. So We got through this. The tenor of things are better. The business is back. We're, you know, at the end of the summer, we're really looking for...
It definitely feels better.
Well, I want to talk, though, about a difference in this last economic downturn and the one that we suffered when we first got into the business, or when I first got into the business.
In the late 80s.
I came into this business in 1986 at 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In 1987, we had the crash, the savings and loan crisis and the crash of 1987. And what happened then... 87 to 92, smash and crash and burn. And one of the things that was different about America was America started to dine out in 1983,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so when the crash came in 1987...
And when Francis says dine out, I mean, I went out in the 70s to with my family. We went out for Chinese food or the local seafood restaurant. Francis is talking about going out to really nice restaurants and really appreciating really special food.
Well, and I also think, Mark, that while your family ate out more than most, you have a very cosmopolitan family, mm-hmm. and you had enough money to do that. I think that if you look at the demographics, most American families in the 60s and the 70s were eating at home. Mom was cooking dinner at home, and every Friday or every other Friday, you went out to dinner.
Right.
And now we're in a place where most two-income families, they were going out to dinner four nights a week and getting takeout two to three nights a week.
Right, or some combination therein.
So they're getting outsourced meals for most of their calories. And what the difference was, we had started with this, you know, people were going out to dinner twice a week in 1986 and 1980, and that was, you know, that doubled the amount of times people were going out to dinner. And you had all these, what we used to refer to, my friend David Page and I used to refer to as, you know, goat cheese and sun-dried tomato restaurants, which was, and portobello mushrooms. That was it for 1986 and 87.
By the way, goat cheese and sun-dried tomatoes was
delicious.
Such a delicious combination.
Still delicious.
I, you know, it's fallen from favor. You never see it anymore. And I have to say, that's a shame, because there should be some restaurants that still hold on to that and,
you know,
and still serve
every
that.
Time I see it, I get a Depeche Mode tune in my head, but it is delicious. I do have to say, and a grilled portobello mushroom with balsamic vinegar also is pretty good, to be honest with you. But so we had the portobello mushroom, goat cheese, and sun-dried tomato restaurants, and when the crash came in 87, people just went back home again. Mm-hmm. Mom still knew how to cook. Mom still, you know, had only been not cooking so much, was still cooking three, four nights a week, and had only been going out to dinner three, four nights a week for 4 or 5 years maybe. And Americans said, you know what, we don't need to go out to dinner. And on high-end restaurants, it was unbelievable. And by 90, we started getting the move toward comfort foods, read inexpensive foods, and plus it matched the mood of the country. And comfort food helped lead into the local movement. And we went from comfort to local to sustainable. Chez Panisse, we got it. And it's a beautiful food history if you look at it. But, okay, so that's in 1992, we've come back. Well, it's 16 years later. And when the market fell out, it was very hard for people to go back. Mom's not going to cook dinner at home five nights a week. Mom's working till six.
Right. Nobody in your family's planted a victory garden for at least 30 years.
Yeah. Well, and
for you to do this, you have to – there's no one to go to. There's no source for you to go back to and say, hey, how do I do this?
Well, and
how do I can my vegetables?
And even if they know how to cook at home, okay, Mom hasn't cooked at home five nights a week, even if she doesn't work. She's like, okay, because of this, I'm going to change my lifestyle such that I used to cook once a week for friends as a goof for parties on a Sunday.
As a goof.
I'm from Jersey. I can't help it. But where Mom would cook, you know, for fun as a hobby once in a while, and now you think I'm going to change my lifestyle so that 5 days a week I'm going to come home and cook dinner. Now, look, I think that's great, and I think there are many ways, and a lot of books of today talk about how it doesn't have to be that undertaking where you can cook good, healthy meals for your family in 40 minutes.
I do it all the time when I'm home, because I do most of the cooking when I'm home. And rarely do I have more than 40 minutes to cook a meal. So.
But one of the things about this economic downturn was it got tough, and people scaled back and went out less often. But restaurants, if you got married 15 years ago, and you have kids who are 6, 8, and 10, your entire married life, your entire social life, your entire...
adult life.
Your entire adult life, you live in a society where you go out to dinner 4 or 5 nights a week. And
or let's not say go out to dinner. Let's say don't eat home-cooked food.
Right. So you're used to getting your food at a restaurant or doing a home meal replacement 5, 6 nights a week. You're simply not... And your special evening is to go out to dinner. And that's simply not going to change that quickly. And I think in 1987, people had the ability to say, you know what, we just don't go out to restaurants anymore.
Well, here's what I'm going to say. I think it changed very quickly, and people did, the bottom did drop out for a little while, especially for a lot of restaurants. A lot of people said either went to a more downscale type of restaurant. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of people did that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think a lot of people retreated to their houses for a year or a year and a half. But I also think that you have people who've lived their entire adult lives going out to restaurants. And
they feel like they're being punished.
And after a year, they felt like they were being punished. And I'm not going to lie. I felt like I was being punished. Okay,
because
not
they weren't coming in.
No, I meant because I didn't go out to restaurants as much, or at least to the restaurants I wanted to go as much as I was going.
Right.
Because economics changed for everybody during this time. And it does. As somebody who's been entitled, and I'm going to use the word entitled, to go to great restaurants for most of my life, I'm missing something when I'm not going to great restaurants.
Well, and one of the great things that did happen, to be honest with you, is a lot of fine dining restaurants became more flexible. Mm-hmm. And there's a precedent for this. If you go to the European three-star restaurants where, you know, Mark and I have spent $1,000 on lunch for two without batting an eye, I mean, it's hard not to. But if you ask them unadvertised, this is back in the boom 90s,
mm-hmm.
and you say, hey, do you have a local businessman special? Like, you know, under the table kind of thing.
Yeah, or price fix.
And it's, oh, yeah, businessman's lunch. And it would be $90.
Right.
And, you know, which is still not a cheap lunch. But it's 20% of what, if you're the tourist, you're going to be buying lunch for. And they don't necessarily advertise it, but they made it accessible to people. And I think a lot of fine dining restaurants, ours included, came up with really reasonable tasting menus to say, you know what, some of our customers, some of our guests, some of our regulars, some of our family used to be able to come here four nights a week and drop $400 or more on dinner. And right now times are a little tough, but they still want to come here because it's so much of a restaurant and a bar is about the human interaction and the sense of community. And we said, you know what, we have to figure out a way. And so our $29 tasting menu was born for a while, and we still have a $49 price fix four-course tasting menu that, you know, people can come and get out for under $100.
Mm-hmm.
And that was important. And I think a lot of restaurants did that very self same thing, and I think that's maybe made us better restaurants. Because I have no intention of abandoning it, you know. And I think the other restaurants don't either. And so we're still the fine dining fancy place where you should come and bring your boss when you need to impress him or ask your girlfriend to marry you and have the 9-course tasting menu with premium wine pairings. But, you know, if you want to come to your favorite restaurant,
there's a lot more choices.
You can come.
And I think that's true ever. I think there's more choices. The only thing that I'm afraid of, and I'm a little afraid of this because I've seen some of my favorite restaurants both change and or go out of business.
Yeah.
And so I'm afraid that we're losing choices. And I hate losing choices. I'm American. I love to have lots of choices. And I'm seeing fewer and fewer choices to force those special nights out. Now, maybe there were too many places. You know, I who knows? Maybe there were just too many really fancy schmancy places and we were living over our heads. But I loved having all those choices. I loved being outside of New York City and being going to those, where I could go to one of those restaurants, or even being in New Jersey where there were 10 or 15 really pretty good restaurants that I could stay in New Jersey and go to. So I'm missing that a little bit.
Well, I'll tell you what sustained us, because and this is for, I mean, Mark knows what sustained us, but I'll tell you out in the listening audience what sustained us is the community of people who call our restaurant home, is the community of people who've made our restaurants part of their lives. We don't have a multi-million dollar marketing budget. We have an email list. We have this radio show, which helps us reach many of our diners and many of our non-dining friends. But our people stuck by us. And one of the things that I will always remember, because there are a lot of tough lessons to learn in this business. So when the good things come along, you got to hold on to them. And I want to share this with you. In the toughest of times, the last quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009.
In the summer, we'll say the summer of 2009 was probably the toughest.
In the summer, in August of 2009, oh my mm-hmm. God. But there were people who came in the beginning of the crisis and then in the beginning of 2009 and said, how you doing? We were sitting at home and thinking, I wonder how Mark and Francis are doing, and so we came here tonight to support you guys. I want you guys to know that. We weren't going to come out to dinner, but we came here because, and I thought, and I believed them.
Right.
I believe they said, you know what? I hear restaurants are in trouble. Let's make sure Mark and Francis are on the other side of this.
And I thought, aren't you awesome?
Oh, my God. So many really great people who held us up. They held us up. Anyway, we thank you for being part of our listening community, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and today we are joined by Michael Gelb. Michael is an organizational consultant. He's written a best-selling book called How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, and his new book being released just right about now is called Wine Drinking for Inspired Thinking, Uncork Your Creative Juices.
Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Michael, what does wine drinking have to do with inspired thinking?
Everything. You know, the original Greek symposium where Western philosophy was born was a convivial gathering where Plato, Socrates, and all their colleagues shared wine, music, and poetry. So that's how it all began.
Michael, I want you to know I have had all of my best ideas while drinking wine, but unfortunately, in examining them the next day, frequently I realize they're not necessarily my best ideas.
Well, this is the thing is, you know, one of the mottos of the book is write drunk, revise sober. You see, if you write sober and revise sober, it's boring and nobody wants to read it. If you write drunk and revise drunk, nobody can read it, but if you write drunk and revise sober, then you discover the creative balance that I aim to share with my readers.
Sounds like every argument I ever had with my wife.
Well, that's perfect, too, because it is the balance of the masculine and the feminine principles.
Well, one of the things that you talk about in your book is you talk about how a moderate amount of alcohol sort of inhibits left brain function and sort of frees up right brain function, the creative side of our brains, to run a little wild. Is that a fair assessment of your position?
That's a reasonable assessment, exactly right. The moderate and mindful application of some fine wine liberates the muse, and I actually get my clients, I've been doing this for years, to come together, share some wine, and then I invite them to write poetry about the experience. And, of course, they always say things to me like, you know, we're engineers, not poets, and I say, after the second glass of wine, everyone is a poet. But there is a caveat that goes with it, and it's simply this, that when you do this sort of event, and one of the fun things about the book is I actually guide people step by step as to how to create one of these wine drinking for inspired thinking parties for themselves. But when you're doing it, you have to have good quality wine, because below a certain qualitative level, you don't get poetry, you just get limericks. You know, I once had some wine in a bucket. It can get kind of scary.
Speaking as an Irishman from the land of limericks and poetry, I never realized the distinction before.
And coming from the background that Francis and I do, which is a high-end restaurant background, we appreciate that there is a correlation to the dollars you spend versus the quality you get.
Well, just, you know, here's the thing is, there's great value at every price point. But the great poet and philosopher Goethe said that if you want to develop your taste, you need to benchmark it with the very, very best, which is why I like your restaurants.
Thank you very much.
You're very kind. Very accurate, but very kind.
You spend just a moment in the book talking about one wine that you must try before you die. There's one wine in the world that Francis and I talk about when we talk about Haminibarico di Bellotta. We talk about, this is, if you ask people in the Cognoscenti, if you ask people who really know about great ham in the world, they'll tell you, if you go to the top 100 people in the world, 98 or 99 of them will tell you that Haminibarico di Bellotta is the greatest ham that you can buy in the world. There's also things like that in the wine world, where if you go to 99% of the people who ask you about Sauternes, they'll tell you that one wine is greater than all the others.
Absolutely. Well, it's funny you mentioned both of those things, because there is a chapter in the book called The Seven Great Food and Wine Pairings You Must Experience Before You Die. And both of the ingredients, one that you mentioned specifically and the other that you're hinting about, are included in that chapter. One of the seven great food wine pairings is what I call the ultimate ham and cheese. And it's the ham you mentioned with some Manchego cheese and a great Tempranillo. It just doesn't get any better than
there,
that.
There really is nothing like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then, of course, the other that stands by itself. And you know, here's the thing. There's so many great wines. I mean, I love fabulous Bordeaux. I love great Burgundies. I love Barolos. I love Barbaresco. I love Brunello. I'm always exploring. But I really think that if you are a wine lover, the one wine that is absolutely just in a class by itself, beyond all its peers in the wonderful category of Sauternes, is, of course, Chateau Yquem, which was, by the way, a favorite of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson.
Those guys know a few things.
Well, Jefferson actually bought 30 cases of it for Washington's cellar.
What a thoughtful president.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, well, he was really, he's really America's first wine geek.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. He was. Now, I find your book interesting, and you actually go around and organize these events for people to actually do. But what do you think people can get from your book? And beyond sort of just inspired poetic thinking, do you think there's a value to wine drinking and approaching wine drinking in this manner for the larger picture in one's life?
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, besides the fact that the enjoyment of wine correlates with a healthier, more relaxed and contemplative everyday life, that's a good place to begin. It's a marvelous catalyst for bringing people together, for facilitating camaraderie. And you know, the way I say it in the book is that, look, I spent a lot of time in Italy, and in Italy we have something called la dolce vita, the sweet, soulful life. And the French have joie de vivre, the joy of living. So the Italians have la dolce vita, the French have joie de vivre, but in the States, what do we have? Happy hour? You know, we need help, which is why I had to write this book. And I tried to target it so that if you're completely new to the world of wine, you can go right to the pure essence of enjoyment and appreciation without intimidation, pretension, fear, or snobbery getting in your way. And if you are the most sophisticated wine lover, a wine professional with even a jaded palate, well, then my goal is to help you discover a renaissance, a refreshment of the pure joy and wonder of the elixir of genius.
You know, you said something interesting a moment ago when you said that you know, wine is a wonderful way to bring people together. And I find, even as a clear example of that, when you go out to a restaurant, a contemporary Western restaurant, you pretty much most of the time are ordering your own appetizer, you're ordering your own entree, you're ordering your own dessert, you have your own cocktails, your own glass of brandy perhaps at the end, but the one thing that's shared is a bottle of wine.
Very much so. And then, you know, the great thing to do is to encourage people to share the experience of the pleasure of the wine. And I like to create a theme for the wine because it makes it so much more memorable. And when you remember the pleasure, obviously you deepen the enjoyment. So even at a casual dinner with friends, I won't just order a wine. I like to think of, I create a horizontal tasting for them, a vertical tasting, wines from a particular region. One of my favorite things to do, I just did this with some friends the other night, is to have a wine that's from the same producer, the same basic varietal, but at different price points and levels of quality. So we did the Alamos Malbec, you know, it's $8. We did the Catena regular Malbec. It's $22-23, and then we did the Catena Alta, which is about $55 retail, and I served them to my friends, and we found out who the cheap dates are.
Well, you know,
It's funny when you look at different quality levels like that, and I see what you're saying, because we do a very similar thing at the restaurant when we do tastings or classes. The idea is to put stuff together side by side so that when people can compare and contrast, it's a way to build your memory and your experience of it. If you look, it's very hard if you've never had a Riesling before, and I pour you a Riesling from the Mosel on Monday, and then a week later I pour you a Riesling from the Rheinhessen, and ask you to compare and contrast the differences. The memory doesn't work that way. But if I pour those two wines side by side, you might come to the conclusion, oh, I see, a Mosel is a little more feminine and fruity and green apple, and the Rheinhessen is a little more masculine. But it's the side-by-side comparison that sort of makes it click and remember in your brain.
And the beauty of that, you're exactly right, is that people will remember both wines more. They'll remember the nuances, the differences, the experience more, and they will accelerate the evolution of their own connoisseurship by the mindful process of comparative appreciation.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny. I see a real brilliance in getting people to write poetry after having had wine. And you know, when I teach classes, they're a little more nuts and bolts. I'm a little. I don't have the high altitude perspective you have on the whole thing. I have a more of a hands on thing. And Mark and I teach a lot of classes. And one of the things I always say to people is, you know, when we talk about analyzing a wine, we say, okay, write down what you think of the nose, what you think of the palate, and what you think of the finish. And people say, you know, I don't know what to write. And I always say, just write anything. You've got to overcome that block and put pen to paper and make words come out of your brain. And that will open up the synapses or the neural pathways. That will then you'll fill in with content. And so maybe it's a little bit of crap that comes out at first, or maybe it's a little bit of poetry that comes out at first. But once you open up those neural pathways to expressing your experience with beverage or food or spirits, I think it's an incredible value to that.
Well, the secret to opening up those neural pathways is to free people from the fear of embarrassment, because that's the greatest block to adult learning, whether adults are learning about wine or a new computer system at work or how to give a presentation. The fear of embarrassment is what prevents people from expressing themselves and deepening their enjoyment and appreciation. So one of the simplest ways to liberate people from that fear is to ask them the question, what is your experience of this wine? And of course, the beauty of that experience, of that question rather, is that it has no wrong answers. And once people really get that you're freeing them from that common right, wrong, good, bad, A or F, pass or fail perspective, something shifts and they get into a state of pure appreciation. And what I love about that is that you can take beginners, and if you really get them outside of the fear of being wrong or making a mistake or trying to get the right answer, they come up with wine descriptions that are phenomenally poetic, incisive, and in many cases help to illuminate subtle nuances of the wine that the more experienced taster wasn't able to notice or describe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want you to know, Michael, that really describes why Francis and I have a radio show today. No fear of embarrassment. That's how we got this accomplished.
Well, the other thing,
it's the only way we really accomplish anything, isn't it?
Well, and people often ask why we're not on television, and someone once told us we have faces that are made for radio. That's
just, so that's great.
We sound better than we look.
So the one point though that I wanted to touch on is I think, you know, you talk about breaking down those barriers and letting people talk. I think one thing most people don't realize is, especially when they're tasting things, we've all tasted a lot of things and smelled a lot of things in our life. I think people don't give themselves enough credit for how insightful they may be as to the things they're perceiving. And you know, you mentioned that people sometimes will pick up on things that even the experts don't pick up on. I'm always, if I'm in a room where people are shouting out the things that they're smelling and tasting, there's always something that makes me say,
oh yeah,
oh, there is pears in there. I do smell
right?
pears
yeah.
in there. You're right.
And that's part of the, you know, what's so cool about that is not only do you develop a deeper appreciation for the wine that you're smelling and tasting at the moment, thanks to what someone else shared, but you develop a deeper appreciation for that person's awareness and ability to tune into the wine and describe it. And when we take that just a step further and translate that musing into poetry, what happens with groups of people, and I'm talking about, you know, I do this for PhD biochemists, for construction managers, you know, very down-to-earth, less brain-dominant organizations. But what's really cool, you get people doing this, and they look across the room and they think, gosh, you know, so-and-so is far more creative than I had imagined. And so-and-so is looking at them thinking, wow, that person's more creative than I imagine. Everybody gets this idea that there's just a little bit more spark of creative illumination in their colleagues or their friends or their family than they may have previously imagined.
Well, I think there's another thing that you mentioned that is very important to consumers. And we teach classes to consumers, and we also consult to folks who are in the industry. And, you know, when you sit for an exam, when you sit for a blind tasting exam, there is a right and a wrong answer. And that is a little more subjective than people might think, but there are definite things that you look for when you're answering a quiz in a blind tasting as a professional of what this is. When I sat for my BAR certification, we did that with spirits. There was a blind tasting, and it was not, they didn't want to hear my poetry. They wanted to know what was in the glass.
Sure. Sure.
But that's a totally different experience than a consumer, because I have to know that so I can help you find what you like best and consistently get it to you once you tell me what it is, and be a professional out on your behalf, and invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in the process. You're not investing hundreds of thousands of dollars in the process, and what matters most is what you like, you know.
Very much so, and you're absolutely right. See, there's a huge place for left brain wine study, and a bunch of my friends out here are this weekend, they're taking their level 2 master sommelier examination. There are clear distinctions. There's so much to learn. It's an endless study. And I'm fascinated by all that. Been reading about wine and doing blind tastings for years, although I love what Michael Broadbent said, is that you know, one side of the label is worth 50 years' experience.
That's
but having said all that, that's precisely why I was moved to write this book, because this is the right hemisphere approach, and the beauty of it in terms of pure pleasure and enjoyment is that, Alfred North Whitehead was an English mathematician and philosopher known for being actually a really hard-headed, logical thinker, but he said this, I love this quote, he said, "You may learn all about the sun, all about the atmosphere, all about the rotation of the earth, and still miss the radiance of the sunset."
So
my job, and what this book is about, is to bring the radiance of the sunset to light for my readers in relationship to wine. And my friend Craig Williams, who is the winemaker of the Joseph Phelps Insignia that won the Wine Spectator Wine of the Year Award a few years ago, Craig explains it this way. He says, "Wine evokes memories, especially sense of childhood, because as kids we took time to experience the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
Most adults tend to shut this process down. But playing with analogical thinking and poetry is a wonderful way to reawaken this openness." And that's exactly what I'm after for my readers, is to awaken that openness, whether they're beginners in wine or the most sophisticated palates with the deepest level of knowledge because they've taking your wine courses.
Well, Michael Gelb, thank you for sharing with us. The book is full of poetry. It can teach you how to put one of these symposium together yourself, and you can pick it up and you can learn more about it at www.michaeljgelb.com. We'll put a link up, of course, on our website. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks so much. Thanks, guys.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com.
You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass, Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis.
One of the things I loved about what Michael said, he was talking about how children have more fun than we do, so they have better memories and they relate to it better. I've often had a theory, or actually two theories, about why, as we get older, it seems like time goes by faster. And I have two theories. One is a simple one, and that is, it's basically a function of how long you've been alive. If you're alive for 50 years, a year is 2% of your life, and so it goes by at that speed. If you're alive for 5 years, a year is
20% of your life again.
So it's 10 times slower than it when you're 50 years old. So that's one theory I have. But the other one I have relates to how much fun we have.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have things that you're looking forward to, because we all do things in our life that are fun. A lot of us worked for the weekend when we had more traditional jobs. You kind of did what you had to do for 5 days a week, and then you had something exciting to do on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that time in between when you're not doing fun, exciting, interesting new things, it kind of disappears in our memory.
Mm-hmm.
That it goes away pretty quickly. And what I think is that we focus on the things that we enjoy so much, and those are the memories that we create.
Mm-hmm.
That those time periods, or if things are really bad, if we have bad memories as well, but it's those very intense moments in our lives. And as children, we have lots of very intense moments, and you're going to play at Billy's house tomorrow, and you're really looking forward to that, and the next day you're gonna go play basketball, and the day after that you have a baseball game, and everything is around those exciting, fun things that you do.
You realize I had none of those games. You remember who you're talking to?
So for you, it was the latest, greatest book was coming out, and you were going to... That was coming out.
Little Francis headed to the ballet again.
But I really do think that if we want time to pass, I don't want to say more slowly, but if we want to really feel like we're having enriched lives, well, then we've got to enjoy ourselves more often than just Saturday evening, or once a week, or for that 2 week vacation that you have every year. We've got to put more things back into our life, and that will give us the long and fun life that we really want to have.
You know, on the perspective of that, if you work 5 days a week and you don't have any joy, and your joy might be as simple as coming home to your family and having a lovely dinner with your family, or spending an evening with your wife, but when you're working 5 days a week in a job that you don't really enjoy, and then you come home and you're just, you know, all you can do to get home and veg out in front of the TV a little bit before you go to bed and do it again, so that on the weekends you can spend time with your family, realize that your life is 2/7 as long.
Or 1/7, because I knew people who dreaded Sunday night.
Yeah.
Sunday night was the precursor to Monday morning.
So at the end of a year, you know, a lot of people have, you know, 340 days worth living. And a lot of people have 35 days worth living.
And I really do believe that's part of why our life accelerates. Because, well, I have this thing I have to do, and this thing I have to do, and this thing I have to do, and then I have this fun thing that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And those are the things that shape how long we perceive the year to have been.
I'll always remember what my late father said to me. We were really busy with the radio show, had just begun, and my niece was going over to Ireland. My sister was taking my niece over to Ireland And my dad said to me, he said, and I wasn't going to go. I had actually made reservations. I had made airplane reservations, and it was the last day to either pay or let the airline reservations go. And my dad said, I related this to my father, and he said, well, you know, I understand, son. You're very busy at work. It's absolutely. And it was a cousin's birthday in Ireland, and I had shared with him my plan was to fly over there, not letting my sister or my niece know that I was going to, and just be at my cousin's house in Ireland when she arrived. I thought that would be fun. And my dad said, well, you know, I understand you're busy with work and all, son. But, you know, when you're my age, and he was 82, he said, and you look back, do you think if you went, and you were, when you're my age, where I am right now, and you look back on your life, you might remember surprising your niece Riley and your sister in Ireland when they walked into Cahill's house? I said, yeah. He said, now, if instead you stay home and get a lot of work done, and get way ahead and really catch up, and you're 80, and you're thinking back to this week, and when you're 41, you think you'll remember that? And I said, I'll call the airline. Anyway, that was great advice, and I think we all should take it a little bit more. I think
that everybody needs to call the airline.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what we should all do.
Or at least have a bottle of wine with somebody you love. Anyway, I hope that you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. Yet another hour spent with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.